The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040121, Equistar Chemicals LP versus Dresser Rand Company from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. Justices O'Neill and Brister are not sitting in that cause. Docket number 040666, Loram Maintenance of Way, Inc. versus David Piani from El Paso County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. And 041129, Enray Pirelli Tire, LLC, an original proceeding, and Justice Green is not sitting in that proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. We expect to conclude all arguments before noon. The proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040121, Equistar Chemicals versus Dresser Rand Company.
May it please the court, Ms. Claudia Cross will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, good morning. The Court of Appeals decided a hypothetical case. We are here today asking this court to decide the case that was actually tried. The Court of Appeals purported to enforce and interpret bargains between the parties that were not before it nor before the trial court. The Court of Appeals failed to enforce the fundamental agreement between the parties about how to try the case and what it was about. This court should decide the case based on the agreements the parties made about the case and how the case would be tried, what the issues were, what the claims were, what the defenses were. The parties had no dispute about the central facts, and that should control you. There was no dispute whatsoever between the parties about what the product was in this case. The product that was at issue in this case was the impeller, the 42-inch impeller that Dresser Rand supplied in 1996. It's simply beyond debate that anything else was at issue. The charge asked about the impeller. The charge asked whether the impeller was defectively designed, whether the impeller was defectively marketed, whether the impeller was defectively manufactured, whether the impeller was unfit for the purpose for which it was intended. The parties argued to the jury about the impeller, not just the plaintiff, but the defendant. There is simply no question that the product in question before the court was not in dispute, and it was the impeller. Indeed, even the parties' post-trial motion, the ones that the Court of Appeals concluded raised the economic loss rule somehow through the assertion of a no-evidence point and a second motion for JNOB that was never ruled on. But even they, those motions, refer to no evidence of design defect of the impeller, marketing defect of the impeller, manufacturing defect of the impeller. The economic loss rule was nowhere in this case either. It was not pled. It wasn't mentioned. It wasn't hinted at. There was no suggestion whatsoever that the economic loss rule was in play here. Nor was there a dispute about whether there was an election of remedies. The Court of Appeals sua sponte held Equistar to such an election. An election of remedies, as we know, is an affirmative defense. It was never mentioned. It wasn't raised. There was no dispute between the parties that there was no election of remedies required here. first of all, no election of remedies would be required because we weren't seeking inconsistent remedies. We were asserting separate causes of action.
Ms. Frost, I'm interested in this components part doctrine and if that is different or should it be different from a manufacturer that supplies a replacement part versus a manufacturer that supplies a part specifically for this type of equipment.
What, Your Honor, it depends entirely on the facts of the case.
Well, how does it resolve your issue here?
Well, frankly, the economic loss rule, in our opinion, is not in the case, so it doesn't really, it shouldn't resolve our issue at all. It shouldn't be in the case. The question was the product, was the impeller, and the impeller damaged other property, and whether you apply the economic loss rule, if you assume the economic loss rule is in the case, which we don't think it is, it was never raised, it was never put there in any way. But if you assume that it is, the question then becomes, if the product definition is left alone, which even if the court were to reach the economic loss rule and conclude it was in the case, the product definition was never raised before. It was not before the appellate court. It was out of bounds to change by the appellate court. So if the product definition is the impeller, then the question becomes, does the damage that the impeller caused to other property mean that EchoStar can only recover damage to the other property in tort?
Besides the fact that, or besides your argument, that the parties treated the impeller as the product, apart from that, what is it about the facts that makes the impeller the product in this situation? Because it seems that it's you could easily imagine situations where the impeller was a part of the compressor and the whole thing was the problem. What is it, in your view, apart from the way the case was tried and that sort of thing, that makes the impeller a product separate from the compressor?
Well, I think Your Honor is referring to the integrated parts type case where, like in Mid-Continent or in any of the Admiralty cases where the party's bargain has as its object the provision of an integrated something, a vessel, a compressor, an engine, an airplane, any integrated part. If the object of the party's bargain is to sell an integrated product to the plaintiff, then the definition of the product will be determined by the object of the bargain. If it's a vessel,
would it make any? I mean, clearly the parties contemplated a whole compressor
in 1975,
yes.
Perhaps.
But later, it seems like it just so happens that they continue to deal with each other on the impeller and the rotor, and they might have dealt with EchoStar might have gone to other.
That's
supply.
Absolutely true.
And then would that make a difference?
I don't think the issue of who the supplier is should matter. I think the issue is what is the object of the bargain. Here, we have custom engineered, modified, and designed special impellers that are provided in 1996. This is not the sale of a compressor in 1996. This is the sale of a specific custom engineered part. It should not fall into the replacement parts except or concept under the economic loss rule or under the component parts concept because it is not a component of an integrated product that was the object of the party's bargain.
Just out of curiosity, I didn't see it in the briefs, but did the compressor have to be modified when a different kind of impeller was used?
The
44 instead of the 42?
The compressor was only modified with regard to its output, as far as I understand, and the speed at which it operated when the 44-inch. There may have been other adjustments, but I'm unaware of that.
That theory would have, especially in that type of industry, they always, most of the time, require for specialty equipment, specialty component parts in that industry. But if you take that over to, say, an automobile, if I want to have a specialty part manufactured for my 1998 Cobra Mustang to make it go faster. Are you saying that I would have a cause of action against the manufacturer of that specialty part as would any other individual modifies his or her vehicle?
Yes. You would have a cause of action against him in warranty or in tort. same reason, depending on what the agreement was, depending on what the facts were, if you buy a modified impeller, if the economic loss rule isn't involved, assume that it is, and assume that it's depends on whether it's the Signal Oil rule or the Mid-Continent rule or East River, but just assume that it's involved, then you would find yourself in a situation here where you would have potentially a warranty claim against the manufacturer of the modified part, and you could recover damage if that's the product, which it would be in that circumstance. And then you would recover damages to the car and anything else that was influenced by the failure of that part in tort, or you could.
Now go on and drive at an excessive speed and run into an 18-wheeler that goes on and tips the scale and causes an explosion, and so you'd follow the line back to the manufacturer of the specialty part.
Well,
perhaps.
Again, you'd use a comparative analysis there, of course, in your typical products liability and other kinds of comparative responsibility analyses. They apply to warranty, implied warranty claims.
Why doesn't the economic loss rule apply here? Because I've read the opinion from the Court of Appeals. I'm trying to understand why you don't think it applies in this situation, although the parties didn't raise it.
Well, that's the principal reason that we don't think it applies, is because it was not raised in the proper. And we believe it's in the nature of an avoidance or damages limitation, and it needs to be raised. The party needs to be on notice about what the claims are that are being asserted against it. And in this instance, there was no notice, none whatsoever. And we believe that that type of trial by or appeal by ambush should not be countenanced, and our rules don't permit it. That's the principal reason we don't believe it's in the case. Another reason we don't believe it's in the case is because Signal Oil is valid precedent, we submit, and the Signal Oil rule would have essentially prescribed the application of the economic loss rule in this case.
The sentence in Signal Oil is sort of difficult, and your answer to the sneaker example that's in the responsive brief is, well, no rule is perfect, but it seems to be it ought to be a little more perfect than that. It just seems to me that sentence would lead to some awfully untoward results.
Your Honor, we submit that the court could certainly, if the court chooses to depart from Signal or determine that Signal doesn't state the rule of decision here, we should still focus on the facts of this case. In this case, the impeller is the product, and the question is, does Equistar have a tort claim for damage to the impeller? That if Signal is up for grabs, that's the issue.
So even, just to be clear, your position is even if the sentence in Signal is not the law, and that we can still argue about whether the provision of expert engineering services makes the case different, you can win independently on the impeller being the product.
Yes, and we can win if we are limited in any way by the economic loss rule as announced in Mid-Continent or East River. It's only to limit our claim for damages to the impeller itself, the product itself, to a warranty claim, which, by the way, we believe we also have as extant, because the product was supplied to us in 1996, not in 1975, like the Court of Appeals opinion says.
And if that's the case, if that's the only claim you have on the impeller, does the case have to be retried?
We don't believe the case needs to be retried on anything but damages.
And that's
the court, of course, needs to reach our summary judgment motion, which is not moved. And at that point, the court, we believe under the Browning rationale and the rules, could remand this case for a new trial on damages only. And, in fact, a new trial on damages only in this case would be particularly appropriate based on the way in which the case was presented in the trial court. The parties pleaded with the trial court to allow the issue of consequential damages and the limitation of liability to go to the jury, and then if the court chose to J&OV it to do that so that the whole case would have been tried to the jury and decided, but instead the court declined to do that. So now we find ourselves with a situation where we have a liability finding, and that's not in dispute anymore, and all we have is an issue about damages.
As a rule, when liability is contested, as you know, we don't, and damages are unliquidated, the whole case has to go back. You think this is different?
We think this, the court can make the good cause exception that that was made in the Browning versus Leakey cases and other cases, because liability will be settled at this point. And there's no jury confusion. It's federal courts do this all the time. And the issue could go back, and the jury could be told, or the court could decide, depending if the parties wanted to waive a jury, the court could decide damages. But if the parties wanted a jury to decide, they would be asked, they would be instructed that the parties had been found negligent or liable. It's 80-20, and decide the damages.
Does any rule or case require economic loss to be pled affirmatively, like a limitations defense?
There's no case in Texas, certainly. There's one lone case in Texas where a defendant refers to the economic loss rule as an affirmative defense. There are cases in Florida, one case in particular, where the court says that economic loss rule needs to be pleaded as an affirmative defense. There are cases, Your Honor, that say it should be raised in the trial court for and it cannot be raised for the first time in a motion for JNOV if a directed verdict wasn't first made on that point or sometime during the trial.
If the impeller were just a standard impeller, no special design, no special manufacturing, no consulting or engineering services provided, would your answer change?
It, again, would depend on the object of the party's bargain, Your Honor.
They bought the compressor, the impeller malfunctioned, they said replace it, one another one.
It could very well be different in that case.
So the unique character of the impeller plays a factor in your answer.
It does, as does the fact that...
Assuming it's unique.
On these facts, we have a separate bargain here. We have the object of the bargain being the unique impellers as opposed to an off-the-shelf replacement part in a situation where we don't know what the bargain was. If the bargain was the same as in this case, the answer would probably be the same.
So if the compressor were purchased in 1995, there was no warranty, but Equistar came back and said, the impeller's not working anymore, we want to buy another one for this compressor we bought last year, your answer would be the same or different?
If it were exactly like that, and that was the object of the bargain, it would probably, it could be different.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Wright will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I came here ready to argue what I thought this case was about, resolving the issue between Signal Oil and Mid-Continent, talking about the United States Supreme Court's decisions in East River and Saratoga. But before I get to that, I want to say two things about what the respondent has, the petitioner, not the respondent, has raised. She said twice, Equistar said twice, that these impellers were provided in 1996. Not true. Their own witness testified clearly in Volume 3 of the Recorder's Record that these impellers were sold in 1988 and 1991, respectively. Further, the testimony is that only one of those impellers was trimmed from 44 inches to 42, and that was done before 1996, and the shot painting and coating was done before 1996. Why does that make a difference? This case was not brought until July of 2000. A very big difference on the warranty for warranty claims for the impeller, if that's what is being pushed here. Let me show you one other thing. It was a very clever opening about parties' agreements. It is Equistar in this case that's trying to escape its original agreement. We did not make any agreement in the trial court about what the product was. Equistar, who is the master of its own pleadings, pleaded that the compressor was defective. Yes, when it came time to ask the jury a question about a defect, the court focused the question on the particular part that everybody had been talking about. That's because why would we ask about the rotor or the drive shaft or the casing being defective when nobody had claimed that? So the jury was asked about the particular part that was part of the total product that the parties had been discussing. And yes, when the post-verdict motions were filed, of course, they attacked the verdict. They attacked the answer to the questions the jury was asked. But we preserved our economic loss rule by making objections to the charge on the basis of no evidence, which were overruled when the charge was submitted, by making a motion for reformation or modification of the judgment, which was overruled by operation of law, and by a JNOV motion. All of those preserve this no-duty point. This is a no-duty point. This is not an affirmative defense.
Just to be clear, though, is it true that the economic loss rule by that name was not mentioned in the trial court?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Kind of odd.
I'm sorry?
Seems a little odd that it wouldn't be mentioned.
Yes, it seems a little odd, but this court has twice held that a no-evidence point preserves no-duty points. In the Rocky Mountain Helicopters case and in the case about, it's Edward R. Jones and Company, about stockbrokers having no duty to ascertain the mental capacity of his clients. And in those cases, those points were raised by no-evidence points, and this court has held that is sufficient.
Do we just simply ignore the statement that Justice Heck referred to earlier in Signal Oil about the economic loss rule and its application to damage to property other than the product itself?
Absolutely not. I think it's a disservice to the bar to ignore statements that are inconsistent. It needs to be taken on and it needs to be disavowed. And here's why. Here is the rule that Equistar is here promoting. That if you have damage to a product itself, and that's all, we all agree, that's a contract claim. But if there's damage to other property, so says Equistar, you get a tort claim as well. No matter how little property is damaged, no matter what the Uniform Commercial Code says, and no matter what the party's contract says. So those are serious implications of their rule. Our rule makes a lot more sense and fits better with the legislative intent, with the authorities from around the country, in these ways. First of all, when the legislature enacted the Uniform Commercial Code, they meant for it to cover commercial transactions, and this is a prime example. The Uniform Commercial Code codifiers, Judge G once said in a dissent in the Fifth Circuit, intended for parties to have some modicum of freedom of contract, and to turn all this into a tort takes that away from them. And his dissent later became the law when the United States Supreme Court decided the East River case. So East River, Saratoga, the restatement, third of products liability, section 21, which we provided to the court in September, all support the rule we're talking about. Now, what to do about Signal?
Counsel, if I might interrupt you just a moment. Your theories would allow or would require submission of separate contract and separate tort theories with separate damage answers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Now, in this case, though, we have contract and tort findings, according to the Court of Appeals opinion, but we only have one damage issue. Was there any request or objection to the separation of the damages as to the tort and the contract?
Not in this case, and I don't believe we needed one here because the charge very specifically said what those damages were.
But don't we go with that? Is this not a Castillo problem in some manner where we don't know what damages are allocable to a particular finding?
Well, but we do know. These are not soft damages that the jury could just sort of guesstimate. We went through very carefully the record, and the cites are in our brief, about the proof of damages. And we could account for everything but possibly $5,000 as being repaired to the compressor itself. And that was certainly the focus of all the testimony. So to say that, well, you know, we should have taken this insignificant part out, I believe the court can look at this and say there is no evidence to support that damage number under the economic loss rule because 99.9% of it has to do with the compressor, the product itself.
Still, that leaves some evidence, does it not, of damages?
at least some evidence of damage of other.
So we get past the legal sufficiency point because there's some evidence.
No, there's no evidence to support that number. There has to be evidence.
There's some evidence to support some damages.
Yes, but that just gets you a remand. That does not mean there is legally sufficient evidence to support the number the jury found. There has to be support for that answer. And when you take out the damage to the compressor, there's absolutely no evidence to support that answer. Now,
you're about to say how we deal with signal.
I was about to loop around to answering your honor's question. Signal, of course, did not apply the rule that it purports to state. It's not exactly clear, but it is troublesome. Of course, it didn't apply the rule because the court found there was no strict liability because of the causation finding or failure to find by the jury. The facts of that case are very different from our facts. The damage to other property and to the product itself were about equal in value. The court was not faced with what we have here, which is, Judge Brister put it in the Court of Appeals opinion, it's like a paperclip going down with a ship. It's the example we gave in the brief about the two cars. One has a pair of tennis shoes in it, the other doesn't. They're both out of warranty. They both burn up. Equistar says the owner of the car with the shoes in it gets their car replaced because there's a pair of shoes in it. It doesn't make any sense. Signal Oil has not been followed by any Texas case. It preceded these United States Supreme Court opinions and, of course, the restatement, and so the court did not have the opportunity to look at that. But if you really take Equistar's argument to its logical conclusion, they're trying to do away with Mid-Continent as well, because the whole plane didn't fail in Mid-Continent. It was a bolt. A bolt failed. So, yes, the bolt was sold originally with the plane, but are they going to say, well, if the bolt had been replaced, then the plane goes down and it's a different case?
But it seems to me that that's a pretty good argument. If you make a specialty product to improve or modify an original piece of equipment, that can change the entire original intent of the designers, the original intent of the buyers, the original intent of the sellers. It changes sometimes completely the entire product when something is modified during a specialty engineering process.
Well, that specialty process happened when they made a 44-inch impeller. That's the improvement. They wanted to improve their throughput. But these impellers had been trimmed back to the original. So these were no different from the original except for two things. They'd been shot peened, which is, the court probably knows, is bombarding the well with BBs to make it stronger, and coated to protect it against the contaminants that Equistar had in its gas. Those things, the shot peening and the coating, are not claimed by anybody to be a cause of this problem. So,
but if we disavow the statement in Signal Oil, you still have to deal with the issue of whether the relevant product was the impeller. Is that right or not?
Well,
or the compressor.
I think you have to deal with it in a certain sense. You have to know whether that was the product, but that is a legal question. The courts that have dealt with this, the Supreme Court and others, have said that it's a legal determination of whether what is the product. And the reason it's a legal question is because it goes to the very core of this division between tort and contract law, which is obviously a matter for the court. We don't ask the jury whether somebody has a tort claim or a contract claim or to resolve the contort wars that have been going on for some 40 years. So I believe we do still have to determine what the product is. Now, you know, down the line, if someone were to say the impeller is the product, we'll still have an argument about consequential damages. And as you know, those have still been excluded by the contract on which we won the summary judgment.
Is there a separate standalone warranty on the replacement impeller?
You mean an express warranty in this case? No, Your Honor. There was no express warranty, and I don't believe there should be.
Implied warranty?
I don't believe there should be under the Uniform Commercial Code because this impeller does them no good by itself. This is not a product that could be used independently. If you say that every time a replacement part is put in a machine that contemplates replacement parts, a new warranty kicks in, you're going to have a continuous warranty. It'll never end. And that's not what the drafters of the code intended.
But if, and I realize these are not the facts here, but if the compressor was sold separately from the impeller,
if the situation were such that you could pick among different component parts to increase throughput or to achieve other goals of the process, would each of those then be independent products, or how would you view that?
Well, it depends on the bargain the people made, and I think Your Honor is.
So you agree with the petition on that?
If the people make a separate bargain to sell things separately that could be used separately, and one's not a really a replacement part inside of something else, I think they can be separate. Now, of course, if you limit it to the impeller, then you've still got everything else as other property, and you might have a limitation on consequential damages like we do, like I said.
For example, a car, you wouldn't think of the product as including the tires necessarily because you go get the tires anywhere. Probably you do over the course of the life of the car.
Right. The tires on the car are one example. An internal part of the engine is probably closer to this case. And if every time you take it into a dealer and they replace, a valve or something, you get a brand new warranty, that's going to be a lot different than what the parties had intended. And this could all be resolved by Equistar asking for, bargaining for, and buying an extended warranty.
But you get a warranty on the new part, don't you? Like if you put a new transmission in a car and it fails, well, something was wrong with that transmission. There's some implied warranty that when it's put into the car, it's going to do what it was intended to do. And if it doesn't, then aren't you entitled to remedies for that?
Well, I think you would be, but I believe more often there's an express warranty. And I believe more often the express warranty on any part is not going to be nearly the 4 years you would get with the original purchase. Most things I've seen in shops trying to get my car repaired don't give you nearly that kind of a warranty. But there could be an implied warranty on the transmission. But the question is, whether you're going to turn that into, are we just really talking about warranty law, or are we talking about, product liability law? In this case, these impellers were last modified, touched by us before 1996, with the possible exception of maybe we helped them install it in 1996, which happened by May of 1996, which was more than 4 years before the suit was brought.
But just to tie in one, just to be clear, if the transmission in the car we were talking about overheated and destroyed the car, would you have a tort action against the transmission supplier for the damage done to the car?
Yes, if you assuming it's unreasonably dangerous, and
right.
It probably would be. And in our theory is, if you have damage to other property, you're still going to have your tort claim.
But you're saying the rest of the car is other property, and the question is, why isn't the compressor like the rest of the car in this case?
Because the bargain of these companies was that this impeller would only be useful in this compressor. It was sold with it in there, and these replacement parts were contemplated to come along. When you get a transmission, see, if you had the transmission and it burned up and didn't damage anything else, that's really more analogous to what this case is about. And they want to turn that into a tort claim, not only for the transmission, but because it scorched a little bit of the underside of the car, and a little bit of other property damage turns it into a tort claim, even though you've had that new transmission for 5 years, and it's long out of whatever warranty came with it. So that's what we're talking about. Why do you flip the entire case into a tort case on the strength of a little bit of other property damage?
If the charge question to the jury asks if the compressor was defective rather than whether the impeller was defective, you wouldn't argue that that was an erroneous charge, would you?
If I had been there and was making the charge objections, I would have been concerned about what else they were talking about. I usually try to get the charge to focus in on a particular part, because then down the road somebody could say, well, so-and-so mentioned in two sentences of his testimony that there might have been a problem with some other part. But do I say now that that was erroneous? No, I don't say now it was erroneous or would have been erroneous to say compressor.
Your practice may be different in how you would handle a charge, but it wouldn't be erroneous to have compressor in there instead of impeller.
That's correct.
Just as if there's a question about a defective wheel assembly in a car, the question usually to the jury is the automobile defective? And then they argue about the part in the car and whether that was defective.
It could be, but if the lawyers were concerned about it and the judge wanted to, there'd be no error in his focusing the jury on what everybody's been talking about. And that doesn't constitute a definition of the product. It's just asking the jury, you know, the real fact question.
There are other potentially dispositive issues that the Court of Appeals didn't address.
That's correct.
So we'd either have to look at those or send it back to the Court of Appeals.
Well, you can affirm the Court of Appeals on the issue that it did address. And we have raised, as alternative grounds for affirmance, other issues, statute of repose, other concepts like that, that could theoretically wipe the whole case out. But we're not asking to wipe the whole case out because we didn't file a petition because we were satisfied with what the Court of Appeals did. But we can still raise those issues in the request to have the Court of Appeals affirmed on those grounds. I'd like to briefly mention this negligence issue because it's critically important. The charge restricts the jury to consideration of evidence after January 1st, 1996. The only thing that could have been done after 1996, according to the evidence, was helping with the turnaround that was in April and May of 1996. All the work on the impellers had already been done, the shop painting, the coating, the trimming, and they had been returned to Equistar. But because of that jury instruction, the only kind of negligence that Equistar could possibly have is a negligent undertaking case, that we undertook some further duty. And that's how they argued it to the jury. They said, well, they were negligent in that they did not tell us about resonance, this thing they've been hearing about for years, and they did not change the design. Well, those are undertaking kind of concepts. This court held in Torrington versus Stutzman that a global negligence charge does not submit undertaking because it lacks the elements, and so they cannot prevail on their negligence claim either. Of course, the economic loss rule, as this court has held in Southwestern Bell versus Delaney and Jim Walter Holmes, bars claims in negligence when the damage that is done is the subject of the contract. And the San Antonio court wrote a similar opinion in the Dennis Jewelry case saying exactly that. So we believe the negligence is out. All the tort claims are out because of the economic loss rule. And we ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and relegate Equistar to the contract it negotiated. Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
I have a couple of things to point out, to clarify, and then get to a few wrap-up arguments. The assertion that Russell makes about our pleadings is a bit of an overstatement. For example, I'll just give the court one example. Dresser Rand breached its duties by, among other things, designing and manufacturing defective impellers for the OP1 compressor. So any suggestion that we didn't raise the issue of what the product was being the impeller in our pleadings is inappropriate, wrong. The second is whether the impellers were provided in 1988-1991. The impellers were not, those impellers were not the impellers that failed. Those impellers were provided to Equistar, but they were not shot peened, they were not coated, they were not trimmed. One was a 42, one was a 44.
Same metal?
Same metal.
So same, but the other things were done to it.
Other things were done to it. And significantly, when the new impeller was put in the equipment in 1996, Dresser Rand told us specifically to run that impeller faster. We were told to run it faster. Not the maximum continuous operating speed, which is referred to in the case, but the operating speed was faster than...
Well, but this was all at the request of Equistar to increase production.
I beg your pardon?
This was all at Equistar's request to in-
increase production.
Absolutely.
So as a means of doing that,
absolutely.
Running faster, bigger impeller.
Absolutely.
All of that.
Absolutely.
So you asked them
yes,
to design a system from an existing compressor to increase the production.
That's right. It's just like if I took in my Mercedes, 10-year-old Mercedes diesel, and asked the Mercedes dealer to make it run faster. It's the same kind of thing. Yes, I would have asked for it, but I wasn't asking for something that was going to fail and that was defective and that they should have tested and provided a reasonable assurance to me from an engineering standpoint that it was safe when it wasn't, which is what happened here. Could you have, by
negotiating a warranty, covered the same damages that you're seeking in tort?
We could have, depending on what the party's bargain was, they could have limited our warranty. We could have negotiated for a warranty, too. Sure.
So why does that not make this more in the nature of a UCC-type claim rather than a tort claim that the parties could have bargained for at the time they ordered the impellers or modification of the impellers?
That's the fundamental issue here, Your Honor, about deciding this case on its facts. Certainly, parties could bargain for certain types of special provisions in their contracts, but there is no evidence here that we did. In fact, the bargain we struck was to get impellers that would work. Those impellers, we have a warranty claim for those impellers. It's implied. There is no express warranty. We have an implied warranty claim, and we also have a tort claim. And the question becomes, going back to Signal and Mid-Continent again, the question depends on Texas law. First, stepping back one more step, is the economic loss rule in the case? We submit it's not. If it is, what's the rule? Is it Signal?
Well, he's argued that that error was preserved by objecting to the charge and JNOV and so forth.
Well,
why isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, there isn't an objection to the charge or to in a JNOV that says anything whatsoever about the economic loss rule. Is a no-evidence objection sufficient to raise the economic loss rule? We submit no, it is not. It shouldn't be. You don't. How can a trial court know what you're objecting to if you say no evidence? And that's supposed to conjure up the economic loss rule and say the damages should be limited and the product's not the impeller. And it means you get to retrade the whole case. No evidence doesn't carry all that with it. Or if it does, it shouldn't. That's my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Frost. That concludes the argument, and the court will now take a brief recess.